Hello, everybody. This is UCI Conversations, and I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeier. My very, very, very special guest today is Penn State University Geosciences Professor Richard Alley. His expertise is climate change and abrupt climate change, which we'll hear more about during the interview. This is what I can tell you about Richard after preparing for the last couple weeks to him coming on the show. If you're going to listen to one person about climate change, Professor Richard Alley is the man. He has been studying this field for over four decades. He's a co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Prize, having participated in the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was the host of the PBS miniseries Earth, the Operator's Manual, and authored the book by the same title. He also authored the popular ice core testing climate change book, The 2 Mile Time Machine. He is all over YouTube and has published hundreds of academic papers. He has made multiple research trips to Antarctica, Greenland, and Alaska. And perhaps no better acknowledgement can be made except by his old tentmate from Greenland, UCI Earth System scientist Professor Eric Saltzman, who says, "Richard Alley is an absolutely brilliant scientist who will tell you more about your research and what you are working on than you actually know yourself." So there you go. One final big tidbit is Professor Alley will be speaking at UCI as part of the Illuminations program on Tuesday, March 10th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in the Student Center. And I'll give details at the end of the interview of how to register for his appearance, because as you will hear and see in your mind, Richard is an excellent storyteller and he's very compelling. With that, welcome, Professor Alley. How are you today?
Oh, Kevin, I'm doing fine, and greetings to you and to your listeners. I'm a little embarrassed by what you said about me, but I'll try to live up to it, so thank you.
Fantastic. Well, for this up-close and personal interview, let's just start from the start. I understand you grew up in the Columbus, Ohio area. Is that true?
Yep, first suburb north of Columbus, went to Ohio State, rode my bicycle down to work with the glaciologist during the summers, and so I started on ice the summer after my freshman year, which is way back.
Did you always have a sense that you were going to be a scientist growing up?
I desperately loved climbing mountains and collecting rocks and crawling through caves, so yeah, science was the main target, I think.
Yeah. How did you end up at Penn State?
Ohio State for my bachelor's, my master's, a little time with an oil company to see if I liked that, back to Ohio State to do the master's, and then my advisor there said, look, go work with the best person in the world for your PhD, so I went to Wisconsin and worked with Charlie Bentley and got the PhD, which was an experience. My first try melted, but we got it done, mm-hmm. And eventually the job opened at Penn State, and I was hired by the person who's now our president, again, a lot of years ago, and I got here and it stuck.
Gotcha. How long have you been at Penn State, by the way?
So it came in the fall of 1988, so okay. Yes, I've grown gray in the service.
First of all, can you tell us the difference between glaciers and ice sheets?
Yeah, so you could call an ice sheet a glacier. If it's a pile of ice and it moves, it flows under its own weight, then we can call it a glacier. And if it's big enough, then we call it an ice sheet. So okay. If you're really impressed with it, you could call it an ice sheet. Smaller ones are ice caps. But the terminology is less important than it's a big pile of old ice spreading under its own weight.
Gotcha. And when's the first time that you went to one of these ice sheets?
Yeah, January of 1978.
Wow.
This grand old geologist named David Elliott, a fantastic person, was director of what's now the Byrd Center at Ohio State. And he was headed down to do work on geology on offshore islands in the tip of the peninsula. And every day he walked past, and I was sitting there working on ice with Ian Willens, and he needed a warm body to carry things. And we went on this little research vessel, and we took the Zodiac ashore, and there were penguins and seals and whales and albatross, and oh my goodness, what a glorious hell.
Wow. And was this Antarctica, or?
This was Antarctica, yes.
Okay, wow. How long were you down there the first time?
That one was a month or so, and it was one of these that we were working a lot of little tiny islands trying to do the geology, and at one point David said, "Now, be clear, when the seal hunters were down here hunting seals, they visited almost everything." But he said, "There's no record of any human being having been on this island before."
Wow. And, when did you first start, becoming alarmed or, interested, hey, climate, there's something going on? Was it just with the pollution issues or what was it?
Yeah, it's all grown, It's sort of as the science has gotten better, I've gotten older, so in some ways we've grown up together. But when I was a student, we knew that climate changed. We knew that climate change affected things. And at that point, CO2 was a greenhouse gas that had been known since the 1800s. But the history of Earth's climate was still pretty unclear. What caused it to change? Why did it do so? And as we've learned, it just has become clearer and clearer that the biggest control on the history of climate really has been CO2. Mm-hmm. And that I have played tiny little role in the big community that has done this work. You will meet the person. This happens. You'll meet the person and says, "Well, climate's always changed, so we shouldn't worry about it." Mm-hmm. You've never met the person who said, "Well, the hills up there have always burned, so we shouldn't worry about that kid with the illegal fireworks." Right? Climate has always changed proves climate is changeable. And when we ask, why did climate change? Of the many things that have mattered, CO2 has been the biggest one. And so this realization has grown during my career, and it strengthens what we've known from other directions, that what we're doing with fossil fuel CO2 is a huge deal.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that, the science has told us, 30 years ago, the science told us what we thought would happen, and it has happened. So, from 30 years ago, we are where we are today, and the research, the science predicted it. Can you say what is being predicted now for 15 years and 30 years?
Right. So it is, by the time you get to 30 years and a little beyond, the biggest issue now is the decisions that we make. So it is, we're raising CO2, the world is warming. The warming has certain effects, sea level rise, ice melts in the mountains, the water goes in the ocean, that raises the ocean. The ocean gets warmer, the water expands, that raises the ocean. So sea level rise happens. When conditions are right, there's more water in the air, so it can rain harder, so you can get bigger floods, more heat waves, fewer cold snaps. This is happening, and it was predicted, and it really has happened. We will get more of them, and how much more of this, how many more changes really depend as much more on our decisions as anything else. So if you want to know, next year, it's going to be a tiny bit warmer than this year, plus or minus a fair amount of uncertainty about what the Pacific does and whether it sloshes cold in a La Nina or it sloshes warm in an El Nino. And if a big volcano blocks the sun, the next year might be a little cold. And so there's a little up and down from nature and a little up and up from us. By the time I'm really getting old, the up and downs cancel out and the up and up wins, and it's going to be warmer because of us. And how much warmer depends on what we start deciding to do.
Mm-hmm. If you joined us late, you are listening to UCI Conversations. I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeier. And my guest today is 2007 Nobel Prize co-recipient and PBS miniseries host Dr. Richard Alley, who is a geologist and abrupt climate change expert from Penn State University. He will be speaking at UCI on Tuesday, March 10th. Right now, he answers my question on what is predicted for Earth if we do nothing about our CO2 emissions. If we do nothing, what happens?
Yeah, we're on track to, and still there are these questions about the price of renewable energy has been dropping so rapidly, and we can come back to this, but just how much of the fossil fuel we will burn is up in the air now, and maybe we'll roll over anyway because the alternatives are becoming so nice. But if we continue on a rapid burning path, by the time today's students are old, there's some chance that we will start to make places on Earth fatal for unprotected people.
Mm.
So, you know, you do not, under any circumstances, lock your little dog in the car on a hot, sunny day because your little dog will die.
Mm.
And you could get to a world at the end of this century under strong warming that you're a human, you're naked, you're drinking water, you're in the shade, you're in the wind, and you're going to die of heat stroke. Long before you get there, you probably don't want to live in that place because you can't work. Under the really strong warming, much of the ability to work outside for many of the world's people will be lost in hot times going forward. And that will have real impacts on farmers and on farm animals and on a whole bunch of other things. So sort of heat stress can become pretty bad by the time we get to the end of the century if we don't roll over the warming. Yeah.
Where are we on a national basis? I understand you're a Republican, so how does that feel to be a Republican and be very concerned about climate change? Is that just a generalization that's not necessarily true?
There are a whole lot of people across the political spectrum who get it. The interest is rising. The concern is rising. There still are difficulties. And my impression is that, in fact, the vast majority of people really do get it at some level now, that we are changing climate, that the climate is changing, that they see it around them. And depending on how you ask the question, people will sort of kind of deny it sometimes because of other considerations. I am an X and the X's don't say Y. But I think you talk to people and they realize that they are living in a different world than their grandparents lived in.
When was the last time the Earth was glacier free?
Right. So totally the ice really pops into Antarctica sometime about the Oligocene, so what's 35 million years ago or something like that. So go back too much before that, and at least near sea level, there's no ice on the Earth. So CO2 was really high. It was really hot. You probably would not have wanted to live in the tropics because it was really hot. And you might have liked to live near the poles because it was nice and temperate, and you would have enjoyed it there.
Interesting.
But the tropics are bigger. Remember, this is an interesting thing, right? The poles are the little cap on the top and the bottom, and the tropics are the big band around the middle. And it was there's this fascinating event about 55, 56 million years ago. Nature belched out a lot of CO2. It was more or less as much CO2 as we might put out if we really keep working hard at burning fossil fuels this century. And it got really hot. And out in Wyoming, the large warm-blooded animals became dwarfed, either because their food wasn't very nutritious or because it was too hot to be successful as a large warm-blooded animal, or both. So we were making it hard. Nature made it hard with high CO2 for large warm-blooded animals in Wyoming.
How did nature produce all that CO2?
Right. The biggest things that have spiked in the past from nature are big outpourings of volcanoes.
Yeah.
So in the modern world, humans are sort of 100 times more CO2 than volcanoes. But over long times, the volcanoes still matter because they just keep putting it out and putting it out and putting it out. And at certain times in the past, nature has sped up its volcanoes. Not, as far as we know, as fast as what we're doing now, but faster than nature is doing now. And so over 10,000 years, some extra volcanoes were erupting, and they happened to be erupting in a place where there was a lot of carbon in the rocks, and they cooked the rocks, and that put some more carbon out, and then nature put some more out after it got hot, and probably some permafrost thawed, and a few other things changed, and all of those together put up a lot of carbon.
Gotcha. Professor, Earth, the Operator's Manual, was that 2011 when you did
that?
Yeah,
the book is 2009, I think, or 2010, and then the TV shows came out in 11 and 12.
Okay.
Just a fascinating, right? So the director did Cosmos with Carl Sagan, the original.
Oh, yeah.
So Jeff Haynes Stiles and his partner, Erna Akugino, just fantastic people. And so working with the pros was really an experience.
Yeah. Any particularly memorable points in the production? And by the way, for my audience, if you haven't seen it, I just went to my cable TV and requested it. I got it for free. So it literally is within the sound of your voice if you just ask your cable station. But go ahead, Professor. You know, any particularly poignant moments?
Oh, well, we went bungee jumping.
Okay.
At some point, I had talked about the roller coaster of the ice ages and then the bungee jumping of abrupt climate change. So we went bungee jumping. We're down in New Zealand, and I have to toddle up to the edge and deliver my lines and then jump off.
Yeah. That is so great. I definitely saw that on YouTube. Was that difficult to deliver the lines and thinking, I'm about to jump off this bridge?
Maybe just a little. Yeah. They dropped me down in a crevasse. So they got a mountaineer and they lowered me into a crevasse so I could talk about layers in the snow. So we helicopter up on the glacier and we're down in the crevasse. And the cameraman, Art Howard, is this brilliant. Brilliant cameraman. And he's down below me filming up while I'm hanging here talking about things.
Right.
It was a hoot. We succeeded in getting locked into the back of a geothermal feature. It's in Rotorua on New Year's Eve. So we're back there filming. And when we came out, they had locked the front gate and gone off to enjoy New Year's Eve. And we just about couldn't find anyone to let us out. We finally did succeed at getting out. And then New Year's Day, we're filming at this geothermal power plant, and the poor people taking us around, I think, had enjoyed New Year's Eve. So.
How about in terms of over the years, you know, you've made so many trips down to, I think you've gone down to, or actually up to Greenland with 5 field season trips, Antarctica 3. Are those trips usually like 4 to 6 weeks? Are they about that? Or
highly variable. The big ones in Greenland tended to be about 6 weeks. So they'd take us up to the center to work on ice cores, and the planes would go home, and then they'd come get us in 6 weeks. So it's up and down, different lengths, different things. We've just had some students back from Antarctica who were down for a couple of months. And the truth is, our younger daughter is sort of followed in my field, and she was just down and working in Antarctica, and it was a 2-month trip.
You are listening to UCI Conversations with Kevin Bossenmeier. My guest today is climate change expert Dr. Richard Alley. At this point in the interview, we talk about his experiences in Greenland and Antarctica research camps. Here we go. From seeing the videos of Antarctica, you see these large camps of, you know, a lot of people, you know, doing research. Are they about the same size in Greenland also, or
highly variable. So the first time I went to Greenland, there were 3 of us, and we had tents, and we cooked our own stuff, and the communications were a little sketchy, but then. We'd get into a big camp of the GISP-2 project. We're drilling a 2-mile-long hole through the ice and pulling core out of it. And that was 30 or 40 people often, because it was a really big undertaking, a lot of scientists trying to make sense out of it, and fairly heavy. If you're going to hang a 100-foot-long drill on a cable that goes 2 miles. The cable has to be pretty strong, and so it becomes a large operation.
Right. And does it take 5 years to do a 2-mile ice core drill?
Yes, it did. So the first year was really shallow, sort of figuring out what we're doing. The drill was still being designed, so we had a shallow drill that we just started with, get the early work done, and so on. I shared space with Eric Saltzman the next year, and the truth is that season they did a lot of drilling towards the end, but not much towards the beginning because it was still fine-tuning the drill. And so Eric and I just had this wonderful undertaking working with a fellow, John Fitzpatrick, a fellow named Kirk Cuffey, who's now a professor at Berkeley, and we ended up doing science that we hadn't planned, writing the paper, and Eric came out of the field with the paper on a floppy disk and submitted it as soon as he got home, and so it's about the fastest we ever did science. So it was sort of adjust on the fly because the drill isn't quite ready, so what are we going to do?
Yeah. How about, do you recall any aha moments in that drilling over time to get the 2 miles of ice core?
So the big target there had been hints that sometimes the climate changes were pretty fast in Greenland, but we didn't really know how fast was fast. And we were doing the analyses up there in our secret under snow laboratory. So they had taken this giant snow blower and cut a trench and put a lid on it, and we're down there doing the analyses. And Ken Taylor is standing next to me, and he's doing electrical properties, and then I'm looking at the annual layers, and that's a summer, and that's a winter, and that's a summer, and that's a winter. And we're going along, and this is how thick a year is, and there's a year, and there's a year, and there's a year, and boom, they're only half as thick. And they went from not much dust to all kinds of dust. And they went from the ice was saying that there was a fair amount of acid, not much dust. And now the ice is saying, no, it's changed. It's a different world. And most of that change was in, 1 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Boom.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just looking at that going, holy.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was your first real evidence of abrupt climate change? Is that where you were literally looking at it?
Yeah, for our core, the Europeans were seeing the same thing. But for us, we're just standing there looking at it going, wow.
Right. Wow. So are you still going? I understand not as much or not at all. Are you
not
still
as much. It's been a few years now. The number of seats that are available, the number of places is not huge, and we have students and postdocs who want to go. And the truth is, I'm just an old geologist, so I let them go and do good things.
Gotcha. What's on your horizon?
I get to come out and talk to you.
How did it come about that you're coming to UCI? And then I guess after UCI, you're going down to UC San Diego.
Right. So Phi Beta Kappa has this program that they ask certain people to be lecturers, and then they call the Phi Beta Kappa chapters and say, would you like this person? Mm-hmm. And yours wanted me to come, and I said, great, I'd love to. So it's through Phi Beta Kappa that made it work, and thanks to them, very, very good people. So our big thing now is the group as a whole is still just rolling along. So we have, across the street from me, Sridharananda Krishnan is this fantastic polar geophysicist. We've got Byron Perzak, Dave Pollard here, who are just these world-class modelers. And so we have people who are going out and measuring what the ice is doing and then figuring out what it means, and they're nice people, and they talk to me, so I get to play along. And the truth, of course, is that you have at Irvine world leaders in this, too. So Eric Rignot's group, and between you and JPL on modeling, your remote sensing work, I'm going to the center of the world when I come visit you at Irvine. But
wow.
And a whole lot of us are focused on, there's still climate history work going on, but a whole lot of what we do now is focused on the possibility of ice sheet collapse and sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did we already talk about this in terms of, will ice sheet collapse? Are you nervous about that? Like right now, that could happen at any point, or is it, no, that's That's in the future, but whether it's in the near future or long-term future, how say you?
We're mostly in the it's in the future, but it could be near future. So certain things. The world is getting warmer because we are raising CO2. The warming is melting ice and expanding the ocean. That is raising sea level. There's really no discussion of this. That's as close to fact as anything you'd need. If we just stick with that, under strong warming, sea level rises maybe 3 feet in the next 100 years, and the uncertainty is sort of a foot. So it could be 2, could be 4. But there's still another 200 feet of sea level frozen in the big ice sheets. And our particular worry is that a piece of West Antarctica could start breaking off icebergs a lot more rapidly. And it's got a configuration that's a little worrisome. So let me tell a story, if I may.
Please.
When Vancouver sails by what is now Glacier Bay in Alaska in 1794, I think it was, Glacier Bay was entirely full of ice. The glacier stuck all the way down the bay and out into Icy Strait. When John Muir goes up less than a century later, he makes observations which are still used scientifically. Mm-hmm. And the bay is almost all the way open, and it's now, I think it's 65 miles long. So, and it did not open by melting. It opened by icebergs breaking off the front. And it had sort of stabilized on a high ground, and then it retreated through a low ground to the next high ground. Sort of like a military, it reinforced the ridge, and when it was forced off the ridge, it retreated to the next ridge. And it did so by breaking off icebergs like crazy, and John Muir is writing about this, and it's all very dramatic and what have you. If West Antarctica does what Glacier Bay did, we're very nervous. And because of an accident of geometry, Glacier Bay is a little skinny fjord, and West Antarctica, Thwaites Glacier, will open to this giant interior embayment that would have a huge width. Rather than 3 feet, you might get 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 or more feet in 100 years.
Back to politically, our current administration has pulled out of the climate accords that I understand the worldwide climate accords are. Are we just on a holding pattern right now, or no, there are things going on behind the scenes?
So I think a lot of things, I believe if you were to check what's going on around you in California, that there's a whole bunch of things being done to try to deal with this. Many other states are looking at this. Many other nations are looking at this. And then the ability to solve the problem is improving so rapidly. So there's I have a report on my hard drive here that I downloaded from a very large independent investment bank. These are not far left tree huggers or anything like that. This is an investment bank, and they have said, look, right now in most of the U.S., if we got rid of the subsidies for wind and sun, but we capped the subsidies for fossil fuels, it is still cheaper to add a little wind or sun to the electric grid than fossil fuels in much of the nation, right? And under fair pricing, if we actually really got to the point where pricing is fair, it's might even be hard to justify adding any fossil fuels in the future on a price basis, because the renewables are becoming so cheap relative to the fossil fuels.
You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, UCI Conversations. I'm your host, Kevin Bossenmeier. My guest today is Penn State University Professor Richard Alley. Richard is a climate change expert, PBS miniseries host, and co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Prize. In the interview, we are now talking about how much carbon and CO2, carbon dioxide, is being used for energy in this world in which we live. Now back to the interview. In terms of, you really made the point of how important energy is to our life here on Earth for human beings, and that the amount of energy that it's at our disposal is mind-boggling. I know from the operator's manual, 78% of our energy was provided by fossil fuels. Where are we now? And that was by, you know, obviously by far the most energy was coming from fossil fuels. Where are we now with fossil fuels?
Still pretty much. We are heavily fossil fuel dependent, yeah. So the 78%, in most of the less developed world, there is still some reliance on dung and wood they can gather up and what have you. Here in most of the developed world, fossil fuels are still upper 70s, low 80s% of what we rely on. And so we still, our well-being is still very heavily fossil fueled. You know, I have never paid Penn State for a parking place. I always jog or bicycle to work. I try all kinds of ways to keep my carbon footprint low, but I'm going to come out and visit you with a plane.
I have talked to a professor on campus here who is very pro-nuclear, and he says, boy, the you know, renewables require a lot of carbon to produce that carbon-free energy. Where do you stand on that?
So this is sometimes done under energy return on investment. And so you do put some energy into getting what you use. If you're going to do oil, you have to drill the oil well. If you're going to frack for gas, there's energy involved in fracking. There's certainly energy involved in building wind turbines. There's energy involved building solar cells. There's energy involved in mining uranium and in building nuclear plants. Probably the literature has been bouncing around. There are different ways to classify it. If often the oil is counted by how much energy is in the barrel of oil, but so much of that ends up going to heat. You have a radiator on your car for a reason. And so should one compare the energy in the oil to the energy in electricity, there's some real complexities in how to deal with this. Probably, honestly, you get more energy back from what you invest now in wind than in anything else. It is really looking good. Now, I guarantee you that you can get people who will argue on this, because exactly how to do the accounting and what is fair accounting is still a growing field, and there aren't that many people working on it. Things are revising. But it is pretty clear that if you build your wind turbine using fossil fuels, you maintain it using fossil fuels, you recycle it using fossil fuels, it still pays back far, far more energy than went into it. And probably it pays for itself in months, not years. And it lasts 30 years. Now, if you build a lot of wind turbines, you're not going to maintain it or take it down with fossil fuels. You'll have energy from the wind to do that, or from sun. Sun is looking better, especially sort of utility scale. The stuff on our roof pays off, but it doesn't pay off as well as some of the large installments that you have built out there, for example. Probably now renewables are competitive with or a shade better than new fossil fuels. You know, the first oil well, oil was leaking out of the ground, and Colonel Drake said, oh, look, oil leaks out of the ground. Maybe there's oil in the ground. It didn't take much energy to get that. Modern oil does.
I noticed your book that you were an author on, the Fate of Greenland. Can you crystallize what that book is all about? And I guess that was part of a exploration with the Land's End executive. Can you describe that to us?
Yeah, just an absolutely fascinating story. It's a little long, and I apologize. But so Gary Comer, who founded Land's End, was a world-class small boat sailor. And Land's End was initially selling some things to his friends so that they could sail. And after he built it into a big success, and then he had sold it to Sears, after which it's maybe not quite as successful, but at any rate, he had bought a boat, and he took it through the Northwest Passage. And he said, wow, my heroes could not do this. I just did. Climate change is real. I should do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he consulted with Sherwood Rowland, who is well known, the late Sherry Rowland, who's well known there, Nobel Prize for explaining the ozone hole. He consulted with Wally Broecker of Columbia. They put together a program to fund climate scientists, young people, grad students, postdocs, especially in the history of climate. Huge amount of good. There's a generation of well-known scientists out there now who came up through this fellowship program. And as part of this, Mr. Comer liked to go see what was going on. So he said, I want to go to Greenland. And he took George Denton and National Academy of Sciences, and he called Wally Broecker and said, Wally, would you go with me? And Wally said, I'm having heart trouble. He says, take Allie. So I went to Greenland, and we did research. There's a well-cited paper that's George Denton and Wally Broecker and me and Mr. Comer, and he contributed. He was not on there because he happened to be the donor. He was on there because we were sitting at dinner arguing about what this meant, and then we were going out the next day to see what we could find.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went up and we worked on the history of how the glaciers behaved and how the ocean behaved, especially on the east coast of Greenland in a place called Scoresby Sund. And it's gloriously beautiful. Mm-hmm. And just fantastic records of how the ice changed and when it changed and what was going on. And we tied those coastal records into our ice core records to get a much clearer picture of what really was happening.
Have you had any dangerous moments in your career?
I've been very fortunate. Probably the most dangerous thing I ever do is get in a car and drive to a meeting. But it's, you know, there's the old days were a little shakier than now. I can recall in 78, we're working off of the Hero, which is a little wooden research vessel. Eventually, we came back early because it was leaking a little. After the big pump had failed, it would have been
bad.
Touch and go. And, you know, they'd pick us up off an island in the Zodiac, and the waves break over the Zodiac, and you're sitting there in your Zodiac, and your feet are in this water that's barely above freezing, and you get back to the boat, and there's a rope ladder. And you can't feel your feet from your knees down, but you're going to climb the ladder.
Gotcha. Excuse me, Professor, for asking some of these elementary questions, but can you answer, how did Greenland get the name Greenland? In fact, I always, in my mind, thought that Greenland was south of Iceland, and in talking with Earth system scientists over the last couple of months doing interviews, Greenland is, you know, central command for ice core testing. And to my surprise, when I looked at the almanac, I'm like, oh, wow, Greenland's a lot farther north. In fact, it's the most northern landmass. Is that correct?
It goes way up.
Yeah.
And so there's a number of ideas, but probably the best answer is that the name Greenland is an advertising campaign. And Greenland is icy and Iceland is green. But if you're trying to convince people to come over and join you in settling in Greenland from green Iceland, why you say, well, Iceland is icy, but this is Greenland. Come over to Greenland. And it's a little bit green right on the edge, but it's pretty icy.
Gotcha. And is it just research? I mean, do people actually go on tourist visits up there, or is it just researchers?
Right. So there are people who live there. Huh? And, you know, so a fair population of native people, and then some related strongly politically to Denmark. And so there are some Danes there. There is a small tourist industry, which seems to be growing a little bit each year because it is this gloriously beautiful place. Mm. It's fun to visit. I have thoroughly enjoyed seeing it. Coast has some caribou, some muskox, and snowy owls and falcons, and seabirds off the coast are really spectacular in many places. And so it's a wonderful place.
What are your plans for the future? Are you going to be teaching forever?
I'm 62, so I figure I've got a few years to go yet. Maybe another book somewhere down the road. But for now, the research group as a whole is just doing such absolutely fantastic work, and we're learning so much in such a hurry. And with new field work now happening pretty seriously on Thwaites Glacier, I just have desperate difficulty keeping up with all of it and finding time to do what needs to be done. So for the near future, we've got a great crop of students, good crop of researchers here, and we're going to try to do things and make sense of it. And like I say, the same is going on there at Irvine, and you have people working on very, very similar things, and this community is just really, really cranking right now.
Great to hear that we're part of the pack. Professor, you are so eloquent and making the story accessible to the everyday person. Is there anybody else out there that you would recommend for my listeners that are like, hey, if you're interested, check out this person or check out this book? Any suggestions?
Oh, dear. I mean, there's so many good people in this field now. The young people are just most of the most, you know, I'm a bit of a geek, and I liked to work on my numbers and hide when I was growing up. And most of the young people just speak eloquently, and they're maybe more diverse than my generation was, and they bring more interesting things to bear on this. And so it's, you know, we've had a whole bunch of people who are well worth chatting to. Our younger daughter, Karen, is truly eloquent on this. We had a student who did her PhD with us, and now she's up at Oregon doing a postdoc, Kaya Riverman. And she just, you can see her on some recent BBC things, and she just speaks so well. She was in the field with Lizzie Klein, and Lizzie has all sorts of insights into this. And so, yeah, there's plenty of old farts like me, but it's really the young people who are bubbling with enthusiasm, and they know how to communicate.
Wow. Well, great to hear, Professor. When you come to speak to our general audience here at UCI, will you be giving an overview of what we've been talking about today? Anything that we can look forward to?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to hit where we're going with this, because I believe that I'm scheduled to do various discussions with students and groups and what have you, and then a big one, and I think I'm going to do a little more of how do we make this story work with people as well. So, because the biggest picture, right, the really biggest picture is if you imagine two futures, one in which we ignore what science knows, and the other one in which we make efficient use of what science knows, with respect, with commitment, but we make efficient use of our knowledge. Making efficient use of our knowledge on climate and energy gives us a bigger economy. It gives us more jobs. It improves national security. It improves human health. And it gives us a cleaner and more ethical environment. And so it doesn't much matter if you want a job, you want money, you want to have a secure nation, you want to be healthy, or you worry about what you're doing to the environment and to ethics. Right now, they're all in the same direction, which is make efficient use of what we know.
Mm-hmm. Well said. We look forward to it, Professor, when you're on campus. Thank you so much.
Oh, hey, thank you very much for the good that you do, and greetings to your listeners. Thanks.
All right. That interview was most enlightening. Thank you again to Penn State University climate change expert Professor Richard Alley. His credentials speak for themselves. 2007 co-recipient of the Nobel Prize for Climate Change Research and being a professor's professor. Don't forget, Professor Alley is coming to UCI and will be giving a presentation called Finding the Good News on Energy and the Environment. The date is Tuesday, March 10th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. in the Crystal Cove Auditorium in the Student Center. The event is free. To register, simply Google UCI Illuminations and scroll down to March 10th. I will see you there. You can also see Professor Alley on the PBS miniseries Earth, the Operator's Manual, which is available on most major cable TV offerings. I hope you enjoyed the interview and the information to be had. I have been your host, Kevin Bossenmeier. So long, everybody.